Look with me at Isaiah 23. We are looking at a part of Isaiah that talks about the judgments against various nations. And this is kind of the end of that in chapter 23. You see so much the power and authority of God as he commands all nations, as he determines their destiny. You see the Lord is the Lord of history, not just the Lord of creation. And you see how important it is that we are humble before him so that we don't face his hand of judgment. Chapter 23, it's the oracle concerning Tyre. Tyre was a city on the northern Mediterranean coastline, so just north of Israel. It was a great port city, therefore it became a great commercial, great merchant city, kind of the Hong Kong of that era. And he says, "Wail, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed without house or harbor. It is reported to them from the land of Cyprus." So Tarshish was a port city way on the western end of the civilized world, over around Spain. And they would trade with Tyre. Of course, when Tyre is brought down by God, they have no Tyre to trade with. Cyprus was an island where they'd kind of stop off, and they find out when they get to Cyprus, Tyre has been conquered and defeated by the Lord. He says in verse 2, "Be silent, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon, your messengers cross the sea." Tyre was kind of a twin city with Sidon. So what happened to Tyre happened to Sidon. And there was just a great, this is a great calamity for commerce and shipping in that era. She'd been a source of revenue for the nations. Look at verse 3. "And were on many waters. The grain of the Nile, the harvest of the river was her revenue, and she was the market of nations." You know, the nations bought and sold, they traded through Tyre. The market of the nations has been brought down. "Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I've never neither travailed nor given birth. I've neither brought up young men nor reared virgins." I think the idea is that they're going to be just destroyed to the point where everybody's going to say, you know, I didn't have anything to do with them. "When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tyre. Pass over to Tarshish. Wail, O inhabitants of the coastland. Is this your jubilant city, whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places?" She was an ancient, vibrant, active city. She seemed too solidly established to ever just be overthrown and destroyed like this. You know, what happened? You know, that's what they ask in verse 8. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth? You know, when a great nation like Tyre goes down the tubes, when she's kind of the trading partner with all these other nations, and now she's conquered, she's defeated, everybody's like, what's going on? What happened? You know, how can a city like this, a nation like this, be brought down? Verse 9 answers the question. "The Lord of hosts has planned it to defile the pride of all beauty, to despise all the honored of the earth." God's the one who planned it, and he planned to bring them down because of their pride. That's something we've already seen over and over in Isaiah. How often God took the exalted and humbled them. God takes those who lift themselves up, those who think too highly of themselves, the nations who are greatly honored and exalted, and he brings them down. It's a great lesson for us. It's an illustration of how God views pride. He said, "Overflow your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There's no more restraint. He's stretched out his hand over the sea. He's made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Canaan to demolish its strongholds." It's interesting, when the Lord brings a great nation down, how does he do it? Stretches his hand, uses his voice. That's all you see him doing. With a hand gesture and a command from his mouth, Tyre's brought down. It doesn't take God a lot of sweat. It doesn't take him a lot of muscle. God is so powerful that just a hand and a voice brings a nation like Tyre to its knees. He says in verse 12, he has said, you shall exult no more, O crushed virgin daughter of Sidon. Arise, pass over to Cyprus, even there you will find no rest. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this is the people which was not. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers, they stripped its palaces, they made it a ruin. There was no place for Tyre and Sidon to go. The Assyrians camped out against them and defeated them in a very great way. It wasn't the end of Tyre, we'll see that in a moment, but Tyre was greatly defeated by the Assyrians really shortly after Isaiah wrote this. It wasn't too long after that, or long about 700, that the Assyrians conquered Tyre and Sidon. He says in verse 14, wail, O ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is destroyed. Their great trading partner is gone. But look at verse 15. Now in that day, Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one king. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre, as in the song of the harlot. Take your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot. Pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered. It will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth. So it was going to be a 70-year decline for Tyre, and then she'd go back to her worldly ways. She'd go back to her old business, cavorting with all the other nations of the world. Here, probably the harlotry of riches, of commerce and so forth. Everything for Tyre is in making a profit. And so she went back to doing that after a 70-year lull. But look at verse 18. Her gain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up or hoarded, but her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. The idea is, in the end, even Tyre's wealth will go to the Lord. You think about Acts chapter 21, there was a little city near Tyre called Tyre, and you see Paul worshiping with saints there. It's amazing that God was able to plant his kingdom in a region like Tyre. As you see, the ultimate effect of God bringing Tyre down was that some of them turned to the Lord. That's the last of these specific judgment prophecies against the nations. He moves from that to talking more about God's judgment against the world as a whole, and just kind of summarizes what he's been saying. But think about what he says. This is pretty powerful language. And if we'll just try to meditate on, you know, what's this saying for us? Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, the maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely destroyed, for the Lord has spoken this word. That doesn't sound very hopeful, does it? You know, mass devastation, indiscriminate, affecting all the social strata. You know, nobody can get away from it. God is bringing the world down. Nobody but nobody will escape. And how does he know that? You know, when these prophets, like Isaiah, spoke, I mean, he can say a very bold, rather bombastic statement like that, and he says it not like, well, you know, I think this could happen. You know, it might be something like this. He says it powerfully, like, this is it. And how can he do that? Because the Lord has spoken this word. When the Lord has spoken, we have conviction. We can speak forcefully and firmly when the Lord has spoken. The reason why the prophets had such great conviction is because they had faith in the word of the Lord. If the Lord says it, it's not tentative, it's not a maybe. It's true. The Lord was going to bring the earth to judgment. Why? Verse 4. The earth mourns and withers. The world fades and withers. And the exalted of the people of the earth fade away. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. What was the problem? The problem was a pollution problem. That's what brought the world down. Of course, it wasn't environmental pollution. It wasn't smog or water pollution or whatever. It's moral pollution. Their spiritual and moral lives had gone down the tubes, and they violated God's statutes and God's laws. God holds the people of the whole earth accountable for their behavior, and they were not behaving properly. God was going to punish the entire world. Now, think about the world even of our day as we think about these words. You know, will God bring our world into judgment? He certainly will. And what do you see? If you had to just kind of sum up our era, our nation, what would you say really is important to Americans in this millennium, this century, whatever? You know, what would you say is really, this is kind of the main thing? Well, I don't think it's a whole lot different than what we'll see here. As we see him ending what was important in his generation, is it very much different than ours? Verse 7, the new wine mourns, the vine decays, all the merry-hearted sigh, the gaiety of tambourines ceases, the noise of revelers stops, the gaiety of the harp ceases. They do not drink wine with song. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. The city of chaos is broken down. Every house is shut up so that none may enter. There's an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. All joy turns to gloom. The gaiety of the earth is banished. Desolation is left in the city, and the gate is battered to ruins. Now, what do you see that God's bringing to an end in their world? The drinking, the revelry, the music, the entertainment, the self-indulgent lifestyle, the philosophy of life that emphasizes having a good time, whatever it takes to do that right now, you know, being happy and a whole dose of alcohol to help enhance that. That much different than our day? Is it? I mean, if God was going to say something to 21st century America and say, I'm going to bring you down, I'm going to destroy your world, I bet he'd say almost the same thing. You know, because isn't that what the world, and sometimes if we're not careful, we are living for? It's just having a fun time. You know, what can we do to get our mind off of what matters and just, play and enjoy ourselves to death? God was going to turn their joy to gloom. He was going to cause the wine to cease. They weren't going to have any spirits to help them forget about the reality. Their city was going to be broken down. You know, the city often represents, you know, man's progress, his organization. The city offers glamour and excitement and power and wealth and all that, and God was bringing that city down. In verse 13, he says, for thus it will be in the midst of the earth among the peoples, as is the shaking of an olive tree, as the gleanings when the grape harvest is over. God is going to bring it all down. He says in verse 14, they raise their voices. They shout for joy. They cry out from the west concerning the majesty of the Lord. Therefore, glorify the Lord in the east, the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, in the coastlands of the sea. From the ends of the earth we hear songs. Glory to the righteous one. Now, that seems kind of odd. Would you expect them to be shouting in praise and adoration of the Lord? Well, it depends on who you are. Those who are with the Lord rejoice in his judgments, and they glorify him and they honor him when he conquers the wicked and when he shows his dominion and his kingship. There is joy among the righteous at the judgment of the enemy. And so I think that's what he's seeing. But then on a dime, we look at the other side, those that are being punished. Verse 16, I say, woe to me, woe to me. Alas for me, Isaiah often identifies with the people that he's writing to. And here he's feeling, woe is me, this is terrible. Why? The treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. It's just treachery, it's unfaithfulness, it's betrayal. And it just keeps, you know, building on itself. Terror and pit and snare confront you, O inhabitant of the earth. Then it will be that he who flees the report of disaster will fall into the pit. And he who climbs out of the pit will be caught in the snare. Don't you hate it when that happens? You know, you flee from one thing right into the next. And you get out of that one and you're right in the next. You can't get away from the judgments of God. Amos 5 talks about that. You know, the guy's fleeing and runs right into a bear. Or he manages to get away somehow and rushes into his house, closes the door, leans up against the wall, and a snake comes out of the wall and bites him. You know, that's where the Lord is a hunter that you can't get away from. If you're the hunted, if you're the one that he's bringing down to defeat, you won't escape. There's no way to escape. Life is a series of traps for the wicked that he cannot get out of. Judgment is relentless. God has all these different scourges that he can punish the wicked with. So he says, you know, it's from one to the next. In the middle of verse 18, for the windows above are opened and the foundations of the earth shake. The earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall never to rise again. That's a pretty devastating picture as God brings the structure and the foundation of the wicked to the ground. And he will do that. You know, we need to see God's perspective. We so often are focused on what things look like in our little bitty corner of the world in this little bitty period of time. But the overriding theme of the world is God is in charge. And he raises up and he brings down. And those who are wicked, he does bring down. He does bring his judgment. And you see that powerfully. Look at verse 21. So it will happen in that day that the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high and the kings of the earth on earth. They will be gathered together like prisoners in the dungeon and will be confined in prison, and after many days they will be punished. Then the moon will be ashamed and the sun ashamed. Can you imagine the moon and the sun being ashamed? What would make them ashamed? For the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. The point is that when God destroys all these powers that are against him, his glory shines so brightly that the sun and moon, you can't even see. They're just put in the shade by the superior brightness of the glory of God. It's hard to imagine something that makes the sun look like nothing. But that's what's going to happen as the Lord shows his glory in his judgments upon the wicked. But there's the other side of that as well. There are blessings in God's judgments. And there is God's blessings, God's promises for those who are faithful. Look at chapter 25, verse 1. O Lord, you are my God. I will exalt you. I will give thanks to your name, for you have worked wonders, plans from long ago with perfect faithfulness. God does wonderful things. He's always faithful to his plans. What happens in the world is not the outcome of strategy, of military, of economics, of political alliances. It's really the result of God's plan that he formulated long ago. Now look at what God does and how this affects things. Look at verse 2. For you've made a city into a heap, a fortified city into a ruin. A palace of strangers is a city no more. It will never be rebuilt. Therefore, a strong people will glorify you. Cities of ruthless nations will revere you. God punishes the wicked in their rebellion, which leads them to humble themselves and turn and praise the Lord. God's work of judgment is central to his work of redemption. He has to bring down the things that we trust in so that he can lead us to trust in him. Because if we continue to trust in the world, we'll never trust in God. So he brings down human strength and human pride. He brings down everything human beings hope for and hope in so that he causes us to turn to the Lord and trust in him. And so it's a real blessing, even to the wicked, when all the props are knocked out from under them, because sometimes it makes them turn to God and glorify him because he's the only thing they've got left. It's a blessing in our lives when God takes away from us the things that cause us to feel self-sufficient and self-confident, things that cause us to feel like we can handle everything, we don't really need the Lord. When God pulls the rug out from under us, sometimes that's the best thing you could ever do because it helps us to turn to the Lord and depend on him. Look at verse 4. For you have been a defense for the helpless, a defense for the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shade from the heat, for the breath of the ruthless is like a rainstorm against a wall. Like heat and drought, you subdue the uproar of aliens. Like heat by the shadow of a cloud, the song of the ruthless is silenced. God is sufficient for every threat against his people, the helpless and the needy in their distress. It's those who feel overwhelmed by their need and their distress that turn to God and depend on him, and he becomes the refuge, the shade. He becomes the source of relief when we really depend on God. It's almost like we ought to be praying for some terrible economic depression or some great threat of war, or some great setback in health or whatever. There's so many times that when the Lord humbles people, that's when they really turn to him. Think about it in your own life. Do you pray more when things are great, or do you pray more when things are not good at all? You know, so often we're really closer to the Lord in tough times. Because who is it that the Lord can provide security and safety and provision for? It's those who are helpless, those who are needy, in their distress. That's when we turn to God most. And so God brings the wicked, the prideful down so they'll trust in the Lord, so they'll be humble and come to God. Now look at the blessings God then has for his people. The Lord of hosts, verse 6, will prepare a lavish banquet for all peoples on this mountain, a banquet of aged wine, choice pieces with marrow and refined aged wine. And on this mountain he will swallow up the covering which is over all peoples, even the veil which is stretched over all nations. He will swallow up death for all time. The Lord will wipe tears away from all faces. He will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. God is inviting all the nations, all the peoples, all the faces to this great celebration, this great banquet, where he provides the aged wine and the choice meats, and where he takes the veil away, he swallows up death, he wipes all the tears from their faces. When we're with the Lord, the blessings we have in the Lord, the banquet he provides, is so much greater. He took away all the wine of the revelry and the drunkenness of in chapter 24, where they were just, you know, wanting to have a big old party. And he provides his ultimate blessings, speaking of them in very similar terms, this great banquet that he provides for his people. Now again, I would ask the question, how is Isaiah as a prophet able to speak so confidently about this? It's not maybe, it's not perhaps, it's not I think something like this might happen. Because he says, for the Lord has spoken. The Lord has spoken just as firmly about the blessings to those who trust in him as he has about the punishment for those who are wicked. And you can have as much confidence in one as the other. When the Lord has spoken, that's the way it is. That's it. You can put it in the bank. The Lord said it. He put his name on it. And it will be said in that day, verse 9, behold, this is our God for whom we have waited, that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. We give all the credit and glory to God. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, and Moab will be trodden down in his place. Now, Moab, you remember, came from Lot and one of his daughters, but Moab became kind of a perennial enemy of God's people. See, we want to talk about somebody who's an enemy of God, it's Moab. And I'll tell you the one thing that it seems to me like Isaiah 15, 16, Jeremiah 48, and other passages emphasizes the most about Moab. In one word, pride. You just constantly see Moab condemned for its excessive pride and arrogance. And nowhere do you see that pictured any better than right here. He says in verse 10, "For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain, and Moab will be trodden down in his place, as straw is trodden down in the water of a manure pile. And he will spread out his hands in the middle of it, as a swimmer spreads out his hands to swim, but the Lord will lay low his pride together with the trickery of his hands. The unassailable fortifications of your walls he will bring down, lay low, and cast to the ground, even to the dust." And I've told you before, this is so graphic to me because of all the chicken manure that we put in the manure spreader and spread all over the field. And we had the 5,000 cage-laying hens in a building that leaked a lot, with a watering system that leaked a lot. And Dad would go under the rows of cages in the pits, right underneath the chickens, who would get all excited as that was happening. So you can imagine this was the consistency of a really kind of thick, sticky soup. And I'm just imagining God treading Moab down in the middle of this manure pile, and Moab having the pride and audacity and self-sufficiency to try to spread its hands to swim out of it. We're going to get out of this ourselves. That's just not going to work. You know, I can't imagine if I'd ever been in that manure spreader trodden down, I'd have probably just wanted to die. You'd have never gotten the smell off. You know, it's just, but that's a Moab for you. That's the prideful person for you who's determined, I can handle it on my own. I can do it myself. I can master my circumstances. I've got the resources to take care of things. And what we see throughout Isaiah, God brings down the proud. God brings down the self-sufficient. And God blesses greatly those who are humble, those who are needy, those who are in their distress, who turn to the Lord and trust in Him and entrust themselves to Him. Every time we think, I can handle this on my own, I don't need the Lord, you know, I know what to do, I've got this covered. Just think about Moab trying to spread out its hands and swim its way out of that manure pile. What a terrible idea. And how much we need to humble ourselves and rely on Him. If you've been trying to serve the Lord but not really humbled yourself before Him to serve Him in His way, you just kind of thought you could handle it yourself, this is the time to come and obey the gospel if you need to do that. We encourage you to come while we stand and sing.